Joan smiled sympathetically. I know. And wouldn't it be great if everything and everybody responded to our personal timetable? Henry opened his mouth to speak again, but Jones cut him off. Listen, young man, you spent years creating your reputation, the image of you that people hold in their minds and hearts. It might take more than a few days to turn it all around. Jones closed one eye and held up a finger. It might even be a little more challenging than you thought at first. Henry swallowed and steeled himself for what Jones might say next. Jones noticed. Henry, he said, grinning, has anyone ever told you that you are, intense? The younger man's forehead wrinkled. Yes. Well, they're right. You are. So lighten up. Henry blinked, then blinked again. It made Jones laugh. So serious, he scolded playfully. Then sobering, he said, tell me what you have said to the people whom you have approached. Well, let's see. Starting with my wife and with all of them, I told them I had made a lot of mistakes. I told them I was sorry. Jones held a hand up. Go no further, young man. I see the problem immediately. What? Henry asked in disbelief. What could possibly be wrong with that? Jones thought for a minute, then asked, have you ever seen a public figure, a politician or a CEO or even a movie star, embroiled in a scandal who says, I made a mistake, and I'm sorry. Henry nodded slowly. Sure. As the scandal plays out over months and sometimes even years after the scandal has passed, have you noticed how many people never seem to get over it? Even when that celebrity says, in effect, holy cow, how many times do I have to admit that I made a mistake? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, Jones said, shifting his weight and propping an elbow on the suitcase beside him, the answer is that, no, we can't just get over it, because you, Mr. Public Figure, evidently did not understand what you really did in the first place. You did not make a mistake, and therein lies the problem.
Henry was concentrating as hard as he could, but still had to admit, I'm lost here. I'm sorry, but can you explain what you mean?
If one makes a mistake, Jones began, then an apology is usually sufficient to get things back on an even keel. However, and this is a big however, most people do not ever know why their apology did not seem to have any effect. It is simply that they did not make a mistake. They made a choice and never understood the difference between the two.
Tell me, Henry said.
All right. Think of it this way. If you are lost, wandering through a forest, in the dark, unable to see, unaware that a cliff is nearby, and you stumble off the cliff and break your neck, that, Jones said, with a confident toss of his head, is a mistake. But let's say it's broad daylight. You are meandering about in a forest you've been told never to enter. There are no trespassing signs everywhere, but you think you can slip in and slip out and not get caught. Now, again, let's say you fall off a cliff and break your neck. That, my friend, was not a mistake. It was a conscious choice.
You're saying I made choices, not mistakes? Henry asked grimly, more of a statement, really, than a question.
Jones nodded. In most cases, I believe so. You must judge the difference of each incident on its own merit. You weren't home for your wife's birthday? That was a choice. You shorted your crew's pay? Choice. You bury irrigation lines too shallow and they begin to appear on top of the ground after a month because you were in too much of a hurry to do the job right? That was not a mistake. It was a choice. And the person for whom you were doing the work does not view you as unlucky or even incompetent. To him, you are dishonest. You understand the difference?
With a sick expression on his face, Henry replied, unfortunately, yes.
Good, said Jones, clapping his hands together. Now, you need to learn the difference in how each situation must be handled. When one simply makes a mistake, an apology, an I'm sorry, will usually handle the situation. But when a choice has been identified,
The only way to repair a relationship is by exhibiting true remorse and seeking forgiveness. Now, in some cases where money or property might have been involved, you should also offer restitution, but showing real remorse and actually asking the question, "Will you please forgive me?" is the only pathway to a new beginning in your new business or personal life.
I should even ask my employees to forgive me, shouldn't I? Henry asked. He already knew the answer, but he was struggling with the lesson he had just learned, one he knew had the power to change his life, if he would let it.
"Without a doubt," confirmed Jones. "Many employers mistakenly believe that admitting wrongdoing and asking forgiveness from their subordinates, even for wrong personal choices that didn't directly affect the subordinates, will strip them of their ability to lead or weaken them in the eyes of others. Quite the opposite is true. In fact, the very thing the boss fears, loss of leadership, is most often brought about because the leader did not settle the issue sufficiently in the minds of his followers by showing genuine regret and asking for forgiveness."
"And while I'm thinking about it," Jones said, "asking for forgiveness must never include a phrase such as, 'If I have offended you,' or 'If I was wrong.' A person experiencing true remorse knows he has offended and knows he was wrong. And the people in position to grant forgiveness can spot insincerity a mile away. Better to say nothing at all than compound your trouble by lying about how you feel."
"You know," Henry said, "somehow I think I'll have an easier time making things right with my employees than with my wife."
Jones shrugged. "Your wife is more important. It will be a longer process with her. The longer you've known someone, the more history there is between you, the longer it will take to establish in their mind that you have truly changed. Remember, forgiveness is an altogether different thing from trust or respect. Forgiveness is about the past. Trust and respect are about the future. Forgiveness will be in the hands of others and can be given to you, but trust and respect are in your own hands and must be earned. You can do that, son, by proving to your wife that you can once again be the man with whom she fell in love."
Jones changed the subject abruptly. "Young man, what is the name of your unborn child?"
Henry was concentrating so hard on what Jones had been saying that he shook his head as if to clear it. He smiled and said, "My wife wants to name him Caleb, but I might go home and argue for Jones." The old man laughed and raised both hands in the air.
"No, no, don't do that to such a beautiful baby. Caleb is good. Do you know much about the original Caleb?"
"No, I don't."
"The original Caleb lived his life with an honorable heart and became a victorious old man. Look him up sometime. I think you'll be interested."
Jones reached out and placed his hand on Henry's head. Smiling, he closed his eyes and said, "Henry Warren, your son Caleb will lead a long and fruitful life. He will live his days leading others to long and fruitful lives of their own. Caleb will love his mother and father and honor and respect them. He will protect his mother and be proud of his father. Caleb's mother will caress him, imbue him with hope and confidence, and show him the kind of love that only a mother can. And that affection will mean the world to him, but it is Caleb's father who will lead him with the very example of his own life. Caleb will watch his father closely and duplicate everything his father does. Caleb will become what his father becomes."
Jones watched as tears began to stream down Henry's face.
"Wow," Henry said in a voice choked with emotion. That's pretty scary. Caleb will become what I become?"
"Yes," Jones replied. "Aren't you very much like your own father?"
"More than I'd like to be, I'm afraid."
"I'm sure your father did the best he knew, but he also expected you to add wisdom and understanding to what he was able to impart. You can remove the generational curses from Caleb's life by removing these impediments right now in your own life. At this very moment, you possess the power of perspective. You can choose to see your life becoming whatever you wish. If you so choose, you can move the mountains in your life's path with the eventual help of those who will come to love you and learn to respect you for what you are becoming. But know this. You have yet to deal with the consequences of some of your actions. It will not be an easy process. There are those who will doubt your motives and warn others away from you because of your past. But let me make you a promise. If you will face these consequences honorably and generously, seeking forgiveness with a spirit of honest remorse, you will eventually win the hearts of even those who hate you. Even in the midst of mighty struggle, never forget that you are Caleb's champion, his standard bearer, his rock, his lighthouse, his guide to fulfilling the promise of his namesake, a victorious old man. Henry thought for a moment, brows knit as he stared at the ground. Then, "I can do that," he said. With a decisiveness that said he meant business, he raised his eyes to Jones. "I can do that." Jones drilled him with a piercing gaze, as if trying to gauge the younger man's sincerity. Henry's statement registered as true. Satisfied, Jones gave a brisk nod, got to his feet, and extended his hand to Henry, who took it and stood, facing Jones. For the briefest of moments, Henry just stood there, awkwardly. But then suddenly, he wrapped the old man in a bear hug. "I'll never forget you," he said, choking back a sob. As Jones walked toward the road, suitcase in hand, Henry Warren bowed his head and prayed for the first time since he was a boy. He asked for strength, for courage, for wisdom and understanding. He promised that from this day forward he would be a good husband and soon a good father. He also pledged to be a good boss and a true and loyal friend. And he said thank you for an old man named Jones. Chapter 9. "Hi, you two." The bells on the door of the Orange Beach Pack and Mail jangled loudly as I entered. Pack and Mail is one of the more interesting shops in our area. In addition to the usual packing and mailing services, the eclectic little shop carries books, gifts, puzzles, and candy for any kid who happens to wander in. This in addition to being the local purveyor of Sea Dog T-shirts, a large part of my at-home wardrobe, which features a pirate Dalmatian complete with a peg leg and a patch on one eye. Pack and Mail is also our own modern-day version of Floyd's Barbershop, with Café Beignet, the coffee shop next door, and Mark the UPS man in and out several times a day. Its employees pretty much have the scoop on what's happening in and around the Orange Beach area. Ted, the owner, is a graying, middle-aged man with wire-framed glasses and a bright personality. Lynn is his younger, chestnut-haired right hand. They are among this area's favorite people. Their heads shot up at my jovial greeting. "Hi, Andy," both said at once. "Can we help you with anything?" Ted asked. "Or are you here to shoot the breeze?" "Breeze shooting," I answered with a grin, on my way to lunch and just stopping by to say hello. "Chinese?" "Mm-hmm," I answered. "You hungry?" "Yeah, but too busy to eat. I saw Jones go by the front window a few minutes ago, though. Maybe you could catch him. He's your buddy, isn't he?" "I like to think so," I replied. "I owe him more than I could ever repay. Which way was he walking?" Ted pointed to his right. "Toward Jenny's." The China Dragon is a local favorite for lunch. It is owned and operated by a young Asian woman who speaks very little English. Her name, written formally, might start with an X or S or Z or G, for all we know, but when she pronounces it, we all agree it sounds something like Jenny. So that's what we call her, and we call her restaurant Jenny's. Jenny takes orders and delivers food, runs the register, cleans and sets tables, refills drinks, and does it all with a remote phone tucked between her shoulder and ear, taking calls for carryout. For all we know, Jenny cooks too, since no one has ever seen whoever it is she yells at in the kitchen. In fact, her only help in the restaurant is a soft-spoken young Mexican named Abraham. Everyone loves Abraham, and he often sits at the table and talks with us while we eat. Abraham's name, too, provides a source of amusement here in this small southern community and allows us all to feel a little more liberal than we probably are. Where else, the joke goes, can a redneck eat Chinese food hanging out with a Mexican who has a Jewish name? Opening the restaurant door at lunchtime afforded me the usual sight. It was packed with people of all sorts, from construction crews to business people, surfers to retirees, and of course, right in the middle of it all, with a phone in her ear, was Jenny. She waved at me and pointed to the first booth on the right, just inside the door. It was the booth right beside me, actually, but I had come from the bright sunshine into the dim light of the restaurant, and had not seen the old man, who was so close he could have pinched me. And he did. I jumped as he laughed. "Jones!" I exclaimed. He stood up and hugged me. "I thought I might find you here," he said. I was getting used to it, but it still seemed very strange to me when he said things like that and showed up the way he did. After all, I had driven away from my house not 15 minutes earlier, unsure myself where I would eat that day. It wasn't the first time I had asked, but still, as we sat down, I had to try again. "Jones, how could you have possibly known you would find me here?" He shrugged. "I just came in, sat down. A few minutes later, here you were." He chuckled at the look on my face. I ordered the vegetable fried rice with wonton soup. Jones ordered the beef teriyaki. As we sipped our cokes, we talked about my family and my latest speaking engagement. It had been for several thousand business people, and Jones seemed surprised when I mentioned that I had told them about him. "I'm not sure that was a very interesting subject," he said with a wry face. Before I could reply, Jenny approached the booth and sank to her knees beside Jones. I watched with some confusion as she took his left hand in both of hers. Quietly, briefly, amid the cacophony of the busy restaurant, she spoke to him in her native tongue as Jones leaned close, nodding several times. Finally, Jenny stood and bowed. Haltingly, she said, "Is honor I not forget ever, to meet you, Jin?" She bowed again and went back to her work. It was an odd moment. Jones looked across the table at me with those amazing eyes, but I was unable to read their expression. Tenderness. Love. A peaceful calm, to be sure, but was I also seeing sadness? I hoped not. I was in awe of this old man, I knew, and I was fiercely protective of him. "Are you all right?" I asked, not knowing what else to say. "Yes," he responded with a gentle smile. "I am fine. Very fine." I hesitated while Jones went back to his food, but finally I could stand it no longer. "Did you understand what Jenny was saying?" The old man looked up with that same expression I had noticed moments before. "Yes," he said and held my gaze. "Did she just call you Chin?"
"She did."
I looked at him carefully before I asked the next question, and when I did, he appeared to be expecting it. "If Abraham were to call you by name, might he call you Garcia?" He slowly nodded.
"Most likely he would."
Suddenly I felt as though I could not breathe. The familiar face in front of me was motionless, but changing, moving, and yet it was not. This old man face that had caused me in the past to casually wonder whether it was of Anglo or African descent shifted visibly before me. Or was it, as he himself had said so many times, only my perception? I felt certain that, yes, the old man's face was different, yet it never actually changed or moved. As I thought of him as Garcia, he appeared quite obviously Hispanic, yet when Chin came to my mind, there was an old Asian man before me. Even as I say these words now, I find that point in time almost impossible to describe. It was one of the strangest moments of my life, but still a glimpse of greater understanding. But then Jones gestured toward my plate, and the moment was over.
"Eat," he said. "Finish. We have somewhere to go."
No longer hungry, I took a couple of bites and pronounced myself full. Leaving the money for the food on the table, I followed Jones as he picked up the ever-present suitcase, slipped out the door, and headed directly for my car. "Where are we going?" I asked, hurrying to keep up.
"Beach Road," he replied, "and head west."
While I drove, Jones slept. At least I think he did. His eyes were closed and he didn't talk. But I did as he had asked. I was driving west on the beach road and kept quiet. I had driven for about 10 minutes when, without warning, he opened his eyes and said, "Turn here." I did, seeing immediately that we were back at the site of our first meeting, the Gulf State Park Pier. It was closed for repairs from recent hurricane damage, so the parking lot, covered in sand, was empty. As I slowed the car to a stop, Jones turned to look at me, pausing as if he were trying to remember something, but he never said a word. He got out of the car and began walking across the lot, then the beach, toward the familiar part of the pier where the concrete meets the sand. I followed, not knowing whether or not I was supposed to, but thinking that he had not told me to stay. Jones waited for me at the edge of the pier as, again, he searched my face, but did not say anything. Then I heard it. Interrupting the sounds of the nearby seagulls and crashing waves was a distinct and sorrowful cry. It emanated from under the structure, from that hollowed-out place in the sand, a place that still appears to me sometimes in my own dreams. In the humidity and heat of midday, I had chills. As Jones ducked under the structure, I followed nervously as the insane thought occurred to me, am I stepping into my past? As my eyes adjusted to the deep shadows, I saw that it was nothing quite so dramatic. It was, however, uncomfortably familiar. I saw a young man in shorts and a T-shirt, barefoot and sitting cross-legged, with his head buried in his hands. He was crying his heart out. It was a hopeless wail that was so reminiscent of my own desperation in this very place so long ago that for a moment I was almost physically ill. The boy must have heard us because he looked up. He was so startled that for a second I thought he might run or attack us, but Jones, in between the boy and me, held out his hand, and the young man took it. "Come here, son," Jones said. "Move into the light." I remembered. Those were the exact words the old man had used with me almost 3 decades ago. Move into the light. I had assumed a different meaning then and wondered if this young man had really heard what had just been spoken into his life. He shuffled forward with a sob, coughed loudly, and wiped his nose quickly with his arm. His dark hair was long and messy, but clean. Showers at the hotel pools, I thought. He was 19 or 20, thin and hard as a rail, and even in the dimness of our surroundings I could see the effects of the sun on his skin.
"You crying about something in particular?" Jones asked.
Ignoring the question, the boy sniffed and asked,
"Am I being arrested?"
Jones turned toward me and said,
"That's about as silly as are you going to rob me?"
Then turning back to the young man, he asked him,
"Other than the drinks in that ice chest behind you and a little moonlight trespassing, is there anything you should be arrested for?"
The boy shook his head.
"Okay, then, Jason," Jones said meaningfully. "You don't have to worry about me. I'm old anyway. Don't you think you could take me?"
The old man held his hands out and sort of juked back and forth quickly as if he were a boxer. The boy grinned at the old man in spite of himself, but just as quickly the smile was gone.
"How did you know my name?" he demanded. "Who are you?" "My name is Jones. No, mister. Just plain Jones. This is Andy."
He indicated me with a glance over his shoulder.
"How did you know my name?"
"No big deal, really," Jones said. "I've been watching you for a long time."
That was the same thing he had said to me.
"Young man," Jones went on, oblivious of my thoughts, "if you'll pull us a Coke from your stash back there, we'll get started."
Jason didn't move.
"Get started doing what?"
he asked in a challenging voice.
"We need to start noticing a few things," Jones answered. "We need to check your heart,
We need to gather a little perspective.
Still wary, the young man said, I don't know what you're talking about. Jones looked around at me and winked, then said to Jason,
I am a noticer. It is my gift. While others may be able to sing well or run fast, I notice things that other people overlook. And you know, most of them are in plain sight.
The old man cocked his head.
I notice things about situations and people that produce perspective. That's what most folks lack, perspective, a broader view. So I give them that broader view, and it allows them to regroup, take a breath, and begin their lives again.
After a short staring contest between the young man and the old one, Jason withdrew into the darkness and came back with three soft drinks. One he kept, the second he handed to Jones, and the third he fired at me with a backhanded flip. I caught the can, and I caught his eye. He had thrown it way harder than he had needed to. No shortage of aggression there, I mused, and a whole lot of anger. Oh, well, I know how you feel, kid. I knew Jones had not missed the shot, but he did not say anything.
Thanks for the coke, the old man said. Then he turned to me and remarked slyly, Your reflexes seem to be good.
I was still trying to keep from throwing the coke back at the kid. Instead, I just nodded and gave Jones a tight smile. Jones said to the young man,
So, no family, huh? How do you know that?
Jones shrugged as if to say, Everyone knows, but when Jason glanced at me, I knew that he and I both knew that everyone didn't.
Dead, split, one or the other, Jason said. Either way, no matter.
Jones thought about that answer, then nodded and said,
As far as how you feel right now, I'm sorry. But in regards to your future, you're right. No matter.
The old man's answer seemed to make Jason angrier.
What is that supposed to mean?
Oh, nothing, Jones said with false innocence. I was just agreeing with you. No matter your past, you can choose your future. I thought that's what you meant.
Jason was silent, but I almost laughed out loud. The old man had trapped him, and he knew it. But just as I had done in his place, the young man took one more stab at stating his case.
Look, I'm kind of hopeless, okay? It's obvious that my life is getting worse and worse, so let's just leave it at that, all right?
Jones shook his head.
Well, no, he said. Sorry, but I don't think I can leave it just like that. What?
Jason said in a surly manner that was fast making me as aggravated as he was. Jones evidently noticed it, too.
Actually, the old man said with a reproving smile, Sir, rather than what, might have been a more appropriate response. But we'll get into that later. For now, let's concentrate on this. You said that your life was getting worse and worse. While I believe that was just an offhand comment, I want you to know and understand that, unfortunately, it is an actual fact.
What is a fact? The young man asked. Jones answered,
That your life really is getting worse and worse, and in measurable ways, physically, financially, and emotionally, your life is getting worse and worse.
I don't believe that, Jason sneered.
Really? Jones said in mock disbelief. So you say it, and it's true. I say it, and it's not true.
Jason didn't know how to respond to that, so he said nothing. I have to admit, Jones was exhibiting a lot more patience with this kid than I was feeling, but I knew where he was going with this worse and worse bit. Jones took a deep breath.
Young man, he said to Jason, do you agree that opportunities and encouragement come from people?
Jason didn't answer immediately, but finally said,
I'm not sure what you mean.
The old man restated his question.
Do you agree that life's opportunities for advancement and financial achievement come from people? That verbal or written encouragement comes from people? True, specific people are placed in your life for a particular reason, but in general, people are the delivery vehicle for opportunity and encouragement, correct?
I guess.
No guessing, Joan said firmly. "Do you agree that life's opportunities and encouragement come from people, yes or no?"
"Yes."
"Excellent," Jones responded. "Now, I want you to make a connection. If it is true that your life is getting worse and worse, could that be because you are receiving fewer opportunities and encouragement than you could use?"
"Yeah, I guess. I mean, that could be true."
"So knowing that your opportunities and encouragement come from people, why are you not getting your share of opportunities and encouragement?"
Jason stared for a moment, then said, "I don't know. You tell me."
"All right," Joan said. "I will. You are not receiving opportunities and encouragement that people have to share for a very simple reason. No one wants to be around you."
At that, I readied myself to dive in front of Jones and protect him from the attack that I was certain was about to take place. Instead, the young man closed his lips tightly, cast his eyes down for a few seconds, then back up to meet the old man's gaze.
"Okay. I can believe that."
The next thing out of his mouth astounded me.
"So what do I do about it?" "Before I explain what you can do about it," Jones replied, "you must understand the opposite dynamic. There are, as you might have guessed, people whose lives are getting better and better. Do you know anyone like that?"
Jason was listening intently. So was I.
"Do you know someone," Jones continued, "whose life in every way just seems to work? They have opportunities one after another and seem never to get discouraged. Well, there are people like that, so if opportunities and encouragement come from other people, and one of these special achievers seems to be getting more than his fair share of opportunities and encouragement from them, why might that be?"
Without pausing, Jones gave us the answer.
"I'll tell you why. It's because that person who seems to have the Midas touch has become someone that others want to be around. That person is fun, happy, and exciting. He is a people magnet. And when there are opportunities to be shared and encouragement to be given, this person gets more than, for instance, you."
Once again, I was ready for Jason to lash out, perhaps even physically, but once again, he surprised me.
"I can see that," he said. "But what can I do?" "It's very simple," Jones answered. "Young man, you must become a person that others want to be around. This is far and away the greatest success secret in existence. A man or woman who has become someone others want to be around holds the world by the tail. He can get a meeting with any executive. Why? Because he is loved and appreciated by the executive's assistant. He gets the listing, he gets the sale or the promotion. He gets the extra help, the extra time, and the pay. He gets the chance, the second chance, the benefit of the doubt, and all because people like him."
"I don't mean to be dense," Jason said, "but how do I become this person? I really do believe you, even though I still don't know why you're here. But how do I do it? How do I change? How do I know what to change?" Jones leaned forward. So did I. I didn't want to miss a word of what was coming next. Jones was about to reveal to the young man the same wisdom he had once given me, the simple instruction that had shaped my life.
"Jason," he said intently, "I believe you should ask yourself every day, what is it about me that other people would change if they could? This is incredibly important introspection. What is it about you, Jason, that other people would change if they could?"
The young man repeated it to Jones.
"What is it about me that other people would change if they could?"
He wrinkled his brow, then asked, "What if I get an answer and I don't want to change that thing?"
Jones laughed. "In that case, you'll just have to remember that wasn't the question. The question was, what would other people change about me if they could? The old man quickly grew serious. See, if you ever want folks to believe in you, then it really helps if they like you. So check yourself in as many areas as you can dream up. What is it about the way I dress that other people would change if they could? What is it about the way I act that other people would change if they could? What is it about the way I talk that other people would change if they could? And on and on and on. See what I mean?
I do, Jason said, about the talking part. Why did you say a few minutes ago that sir would have been a better choice?
Well, Jones began, the answer yes and yes, sir, are both correct responses. Likewise, no and no, sir. Yes and yes, ma'am. No and no, ma'am, the same. Got it?
I do.
Here's the only difference, and where you need to make a choice. Studies have shown that to the majority of people it makes no difference at all which way you answer. But there is a significant percentage, for the sake of argument, let's say 20%, who feel that adding the sir or the ma'am is much more respectful. Here's my point. If you are endeavoring to become a person that other people want to be around, don't you want to include that 20% in your corner? That's just one example, mind you. Here's another. There are people who don't mind the occasional curse word sprinkled into a conversation. There are also folks who don't want to hear any curse words. Now, you may not think there's anything wrong with cursing, but if you want to become a person that other people want to be around, you must always hold your life to the very highest standard.
Jason smiled. I get it. I mean, I really understand this.
Of course you do, the old man said. And, Jason, you have an incredible future ahead of you. One day you will look back on this worst time in your life as a fortuitous event. Even your worst times have value and can become, in retrospect, your best times. Know, Jason, that you are destined to make a difference in the world. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so, the young man said sincerely, and I really want to make a difference.
Oh, you will make a difference, Jones said, nodding. Now, what kind of difference? That, my young friend, is entirely up to you. As for me, Jones winked, I'm expecting the difference you make to be a great one.
And with that, Jones reached out to shake the young man's hand.
I'll be leaving you now, he said as he opened his old suitcase away from me. But I have something for you.
Jones paused, then asked,
do you read?
Yeah, Jason said. Then he grinned widely. I mean, yes, sir, I do.
Jones smiled. Okay, then.
Jones murmured softly as he brought from the suitcase three small orange hardcover books. I strained to see if they were the same titles I remembered, and they were. More worn, perhaps, but they seemed to be the very same books. Winston Churchill, Will Rogers, George Washington Carver. As I crawled out from under that pier a few minutes later, my emotions were as raw and on edge as any time I can remember. I wanted to tell the kid how lucky he was to have had that time with Jones. I wanted to tell him how his life would turn out, if only he would work and believe. And I must admit, I would have paid any price for those three books at that moment. I wanted them on the corner of my desk in my office. But I determined they were infinitely more valuable in the hands and mind and heart of another young man. As for Jones, when I straightened up and turned around, he was not behind me. I listened carefully to see if I could hear his voice, thinking he must have gone back to tell the boy something he had forgotten. But after a time, I walked around to the other side of the pier. Was he, I wondered, waiting for me there? He wasn't. I shook my head and grinned, then laughed aloud as I walked back to my car. I assumed that I would run into the old man in a few days or a week. He would show up again, I figured, where and when I least expected. It wasn't until the following morning when I knew, this time, my friend was truly gone.
Chapter 10. The phone rang at 8:14 a.m. Having worked until the wee hours of the morning, I was still asleep. but my wife had been up and dealing with the boys for a while. She got it on the second ring, and before I could drift back into unconsciousness, Polly was by my side with the phone in her hand. "Dear?" She shook me gently. "Hey," I mumbled, rolling over and forcing my eyes open. Polly shook me again. "Wake up, dear," she said. "It's Ted from Packin' Mail. He seems upset and says he needs to talk to you now." I frowned, still trying to clear my head. "What time is it?" I asked. 8:15. "Okay." Polly handed me the phone but stayed beside me. I propped myself on one elbow and watched my wife's face as I answered. "Hi, Ted." "Hi, Andy," he said. "I'm sorry to bother you." "You're not bothering me. What's up?" "Well," he began, "I didn't know who else to call. I didn't want to call the police." He had my attention now. I was fully awake. Sitting up, I asked, "Ted, what's wrong?" "It may be nothing." "Ted! I found Joan's suitcase in the parking lot this morning. By itself. Right out in the middle of the parking lot. And he is nowhere around." Well, I didn't know what to say to that. A million things ran through my mind at once. Was the old man hurt? Had he forgotten it? Had it been stolen from him and left there? Was Ted certain it was Joan's suitcase? "Did you take it inside?" I asked. "No," Ted answered hesitantly. "None of the businesses are open here yet, so there aren't many cars. I just didn't want to move it." "Should I?" "Maybe not," I answered. "Hang on, I'll be right there." Quickly, I told Polly what I knew as I slipped into a T-shirt and one of my Tommy Bahama swimsuits that passed for shorts in our beach town. I brushed my teeth, kissed Polly and the boys, and was in the car within 5 minutes. I made the short drive up the beach in another 7 or 8 minutes and pulled into the parking lot to see a small crowd gathered around the suitcase. Ted was right. There were very few cars. It was mostly the people who had come to work early. I drove right up to the group and got out. Ted stood by the suitcase. Susan and Clay were there from the Winn-Dixie across the parking lot. Jenny and Abraham were standing with Al from the coffee shop. They all stared at me as I approached, no one talking, no one even said hello. I stopped at Ted and looked at him for a moment, expecting him to do what, I wasn't sure, but he seemed to be in a daze. I knelt down beside the suitcase. "Has anyone touched it?" I asked. "No, no," they all answered, "no one had." I understood. I didn't want to touch it either. Strange, really. We had all seen the suitcase many times. We had engaged in conversations about it. We had curiously noticed how careful Jones had always been to never let anyone carry it for him or peek inside as he opened it. Yet here it was, right in front of us, and not a soul wanted to be the first to touch it. The suitcase was battered, yet smooth, in the way only a truly old object can be. Its surface had been a dark brown once, but all the original color was long gone, leaving a deep tan. It was ribboned with tiny crevices and reminded me of the old man's skin, soft and stout at the same time, durable, with dimension and character that seemed to grow more obvious with age. Slowly I placed my hand on it, left it there for a moment, then removed it. Looking up, I saw that several others had quietly joined the group. Tom and Becky from the pharmacy, several of the girls from the nail salon, and a couple of guys from the tackle store had come to watch or wait or whatever it was we were doing. Word was spreading. Looking up, I asked, "Should we take it inside?" And everyone agreed that yes, we should. I stood and looked again at Ted. "You," he said simply, and stepped back. So I picked up the old man's suitcase. It was surprisingly light, though not empty, I didn't think. As a group, and there were almost 20 of us now, we walked across the parking lot and into Café Beignet. I took the suitcase to a table in the center of the room and laid it carefully on its side. Everyone from the parking lot had come into the coffee shop and just kind of stood there until Al began pouring coffee. Soon we all settled uneasily into chairs at several tables loosely arranged around the suitcase.
"We have neighbors that were divorcing," Clay said to no one in particular, "until they met Jones."
We all looked at him. He looked back, then shrugged.
"Just thought I'd tell you," he said.
"Is he all right?"
Susan asked, directing her question to me. I mean, he's not hurt somewhere, is he?
I don't know, I answered honestly. I hope not. And I don't really think so. You guys all know how Jones is. He's in and out. No pattern to where he goes or when.
I paused, then added, I've just never known him to be without this thing.
We all stared at the battered old suitcase, now sitting center stage in what was fast becoming a mystery none of us wanted any part of. We looked up as the door opened and several more people came in, including Robert Kraft and Barry and Jan Hansen. Robert pulled up a chair and sat next to me.
I heard, he said, then asked quietly, any word?
I shook my head.
Al began to distribute big plates of beignets on all the tables and pour coffee for the newcomers, and every few minutes more would arrive, John and Shannon Smith, Mike and Melanie Martin, Jonathan and Deborah Langston, Alan and Karen McBride, the Granthams, the Millers, the Norwoods, all the Wards, all the Kaisers, and those were just the people I knew.
Folks sipped coffee nervously, but I noticed that as good as those beignets smell, there didn't seem to be much of an appetite for them.
Hey, everybody, I asked as something occurred to me. I'm just curious. Does anyone have any idea where Jones sleeps at night? Where he stays? Has he ever spent a night with any of you?
Blank stares.
Oh, well, I sighed. It was a thought.
You know, Ted said, I'd go look for him if I had the slightest clue where to start.
Well, said Alan, he certainly disappeared before. Haven't there been times we haven't seen him for a while?
We all just looked at him. He bobbed one shoulder uneasily.
Yeah, I know, he said. Never without the suitcase.
Since I laid it on the table, I had not touched it again, and no one else had either. The door opened again, and I saw Jason, the kid from the pier, come in with a couple of the boat captains from the marina. I nodded at him, and he self-consciously gave me a half wave in return.
I don't suppose anyone knows where he's from, someone threw out.
No one did.
My life was about to come to an end when I met Jones, Jake Connor said. I don't think it's any secret that I was going bankrupt.
All heads turned toward the back of the room. Jake Connor? Bankrupt? Well, it was a secret to me. And if the faces around the room could be read, it was a secret to a lot of us. Jake was one of the richest men in the area, and one of the meanest, too, if I'm to believe all the stories. But according to local legend, he had changed overnight several years earlier, and no one knew why. Now it appeared we were about to hear how it happened.
Jake began to talk. I've never told anyone this before, but when I said my life was about to end, that was not entirely accurate. The truth is, I was about to end my life. Some notes came due at the same time the stock market went south. Financially, I was turned inside out. Anyway, I was embarrassed. I was scared. So I slipped the Misty Lynn out of the marina and through the pass about dark one evening.
The Misty Lynn, we all knew, was the 87-foot yacht that Jake kept in Terry Cove.
I stood on the flying bridge for a couple of hours thinking, feeling sorry for myself while trying to drum up my courage for what I was about to do. My intention was to set the autopilot on 180, due south, and just slip overboard. Somebody would have found the boat when she ran out of fuel, and the insurance company would have paid my family quickly. Nobody could have proven suicide, and, well...
Jake's voice drifted to silence. His eyes were fixed on a spot in his memory that none of us could see, that none of us wanted to see. Roger Kaiser broke the spell.
But you're here, Jake, he said quietly. Why didn't you do it?
Jake turned to Roger and smiled oddly, as if he himself did not believe what he was about to say.
I didn't do it, he said. Because Jones tapped me on the shoulder and told me not to.
Jake let that sink in, then added,
My wife nearly collected that insurance money anyway. I thought I was going to have a heart attack right there. Here's the thing. I know that old man was not on that boat when I left the dock. He was not. He was just not. I've thought about it 10 million times since that night. I was suicidal, not crazy. And I'm telling each and every one of you, I was alone when I went out that pass.
It's a big boat, Jake, Roger said skeptically. Lots of rooms.
Jake sighed deeply. Okay, fine. You believe what you want to. But the part I meant to tell anyway was about Jones talking to me for hours that night, and on into the next morning. When we got through, my debts were still there, but I had a new look at the whole thing. A new perspective, he called it. And I managed to pull it all together. Everybody got paid, and I think I'm a new man. In any case, I never saw him again until he showed up here, what was it now, 6, 7 weeks ago?
I did quick calculations in my head. Yes, it had only been a few weeks since Jones had come to town.
You all knew my Harrison.
All heads swung to a voice near the bookcase on the side wall. It belonged to Nancy Carpenter, a lady in her early 60s. I knew her from the bank, where she was the teller, and by the volunteer work in which she was always involved. Her husband, Harrison, had been the probate judge and had died several years ago after a long bout with lung cancer. Yes, I assumed most of us in the room had known Harrison Carpenter. Nancy stood up.
Harrison died 3 years ago. Well, next month will make 3 years.
Her voice broke and she took a moment to compose herself.
As I look around this morning, she said finally, I see quite a few of you who are at Harrison's wake. No one has ever asked me about it, out of courtesy, I suppose, but I know many of you must have wondered why Harrison was buried with a dinner fork in his hand. But maybe you didn't even notice it.
Notice it? Was she kidding? It was the only thing the town talked about for a month, and every time any mention of a funeral came up during the last 3 years, someone was bound to say, Hey, remember the guy lying in the casket with a fork in his hand?
But Nancy was correct. We never asked. We liked Harrison. We loved her. And it just didn't seem appropriate to bring it up. But boy, we were listening now.
Like Jake, she said, shooting him a quick glance. I never told anyone this before.
She took a deep breath.
You know, Harrison was having a tough time several months before he, before he passed away. Not physically so much, though that was hard. We slept in different rooms. We had not done that in 38 years of marriage, but the medicine kept him awake and he coughed all the time, so we slept in separate rooms.
She stopped for a beat, lost in thought and memories swirling around in her head. But then quite suddenly she snapped out of her reverie.
What was I saying? Oh, he was having a hard time. He had no peace about dying. Of course I didn't. I mean, how can you, really, we thought. He got to the point where he cried a lot and just never got out of bed. I cried a lot, too. Anyway, several weeks before Harrison died, I woke up in the middle of the night and heard Harrison laughing. And I heard another voice in that room.
Nancy paused.
Where Harrison was, she added. At first, I thought he had the television on, but after a few minutes, I went to see for myself.
Then Nancy's chin lifted a bit, as if she was about to make some sort of declaration that she dared us to dispute.
I peeked around the corner into the room, and Jones was in there with him. I didn't know him as Jones at that time, of course. To me, he was just some old man who had gotten in the house. I was horrified. I ran immediately to check the doors, but they were still locked, still chained. I tried to call the police, but the phone wouldn't work. I tried my cell phone, and it wouldn't work either. Then I thought, well, maybe Harrison let him in. I mean, he hadn't gotten out of bed in days, so I didn't really think so, but...
She shrugged. Everyone in the coffee shop was silent and absolutely still. The only movement in the room was a steady stream of people squeezing themselves in the front door as Nancy talked.
I went back to the bedroom. Jones introduced himself and said he was Harrison's best friend. Harrison said the same thing. He said this old man was his best friend, but I knew that neither of us had ever laid eyes on him. Harrison seemed calm, though, happy even, so I sat down on the chair in that room and listened. They talked and talked. Finally, Jones brought up the subject of Harrison's mother. She died before we were married, so I never met her, but I had heard lots of stories. Harrison loved his mother. Anyway, Jones said, "Remember, Harrison? Remember how your mama used to set such a big table at Thanksgiving and Christmas?" When the old man said that, my husband closed his eyes and smiled. I had not seen him that happy in a long time, but the old man's voice just calmed him, soothed him. Then the old man, Jones, said, "Harrison, do you remember what your mama served? Ham, turkey, sweet potatoes, yeast rolls, peas. She cooked cream corn and cranberry sauce and that green jello salad." At that point, I leaned closer to them, Nancy said, because the old man was talking softer and softer. I heard him say, "But everyone's favorite was your mama's dessert, wasn't it, Harrison? Your mama could really do dessert. Pecan pies, coconut cake, those little apple turnovers. And remember the sugar cookies? But it was the pumpkin pie that was your favorite, remember?" "Now," the old man said, "do you remember what your mama always said to everybody as she cleared the table? Remember, Harrison? Remember before dessert? She would take the dishes away but say, 'Keep your fork. The best is yet to come.'" Tears began to roll down Nancy's face. "As I said," she bravely went on, "I have never told anyone this before. But before Jones left, he kissed my husband on his head and said, 'You don't have to be afraid anymore, Harrison. You can keep your fork. The best is yet to come.'" We were quiet, unsure how to respond, when Nancy added one more thing. "I never saw Jones again, either, until a few weeks ago, and it was me. I put the fork in Harrison's hand when he died. He had asked me to." She lifted her chin again. "And I was glad to do it. I believe the same thing now, you know. The best is yet to come." For several minutes, it seemed no one had anything to say. Then everyone did. For almost 3 hours, people told story after story about Jones or Garcia or Chin or whatever name they had used for the old man. Polly slipped in while Nancy was talking and urged me to tell what Jones had meant to me and how it was that I came to know him. Pat Simpson was there with his wife, Claudia. Pat told us about seeing Jones as a boy and how the old man had intervened one night and kept him out of trouble. We heard several stories similar to Pat's. Sharon Tyler's 17-year-old son, Brandon, had seen Jones when he was 14. He had been in an automobile accident with two older boys. He swore, Sharon said, that the old man he had seen around town the past few weeks was the same old man who had ridden in the ambulance with him 3 years earlier. Brandon had talked about the old man ever since, his mother told us, but of course the ambulance attendants told his parents that their son had been delirious, that no one besides the paramedics had been with him at all. Almost 10 years ago, Boyd Crawford told us, he and his son pulled an old man out of Wolf Bay in the middle of the night. They were shrimping and just about ran over him with the boat. It had been Jones. They had saved him, they thought.
"Turned out," Boyd said, "that old dude saved us. Me and my boys was butting heads something awful. Starting to hate each other, we was. It wasn't right. We knew it. And my wife, she cried night and day about it. We just didn't know what to do. Dang if that old joker didn't talk us out of hating each other right there on that boat. I don't even remember how the man got the subject going. But by the time daylight rolled around, we was trailing the boat, me and the boys hugging and crying our own selves.
Old dude was gone before we got in the truck. Never saw him again, neither. Till lately.
Finally, no one had any more stories to tell, or at least stories they were going to share with anyone else.